Blog Talk Radio.
I would hope so.
Welcome to Desperate House Witches. My name is Raina Starr. I am your host for the hour. Desperate House Witches is not a G, PG, or even an R-rated show. So if bad language, bodily functions, or talk of any kind might upset you, this may not be the show for you. But I'm hoping it is, because I've got a really amazing guest, if we can figure out technology. Desperate House Witches is brought to you by the one, the only, the incredible, wicked one herself, Dorothy Morrison. Everybody, please check out www.wickedwitchstudios.com for all of your witching needs. And we seem to have an issue with technology, but I'm going to still try to get him.
Hi.
The amazing Jason Mankey. Hey, how are you?
Huh? I'm sorry. I don't know. You know, I, like, live in Silicon Valley, so, I mean, like, technology should be easier than this. And yet, it never seems to work that way.
It never seems to work that way. All right, so that was kind of crazy, and I didn't even get to really properly intro you, but Jason Mankey, amazing writer, multiple-time writer, head priest over two covens, I believe, at this point. Married to the amazing Ari, because you can't talk about Jason without talking about his lovely wife. And so, Jason, welcome back to the show. Sorry for the technical difficulties. So the new book, The Horned God of the Witches, I know there's a story behind it because there is always a story. So do you want to tell folks the story, or do you want me to tell it? Because I know the story.
I don't know if there's a story. There are many stories behind that particular book. I've been talking about the Horned God for over 20 years. You know, that was one of the first sort of workshops I ever did, and I'm glad no one, like, had cell phones back then because it was terrible. But, I mean, that's always been, like, one of my big primary concerns. And in 2005, I did a workshop at Pantheacon, which was a big festival on the West Coast for a while. For a period of time, it had about 2,000 people going, which is a really large festival. And I did a Horned God workshop there, and Christopher Penzack saw it, the amazing C-Pen, and he's like, you really need to, you know, write a book, and you need to send it to Llewellyn and stuff. And he made some introductions, and I sent them the things that I had written, and they promptly sent me a rejection letter, which was well-deserved, I think, at the time. You know, and then I made vows, like, you know, and then I finished it, right? I, like, self-published it, and I'd sell it at festivals. Some people liked it and things.
Yeah.
And it was okay. It was not as good as it should have been. It didn't have footnotes. There were a lot of things I didn't cover, you know. But I decided I was never going to try to write that book ever again because it was too hard. I decided it was too hard. You know, and Llewellyn didn't seem interested in publishing anything having to do with, you know, especially male deities. You know, so after I started writing for them in 2015, I was like, I'm never going to do this, right? It's just not going to happen.
Yeah.
And then
several
years later, I'm standing in my shower where all of my best thoughts occur, and I start thinking about books because I just finished a book, and I was like, I'm going to send them a proposal for what became the Little Book of Yule. But then in the back of my mind, I was like, I could do a Horned God book. And I ran through these chapters, ideas in my head, and I ran out of the shower, and I sat down, dripping wet in front of my computer, and wrote it all down, all the chapter ideas, and I sent that to Llewellyn. And they sent me a note saying, how would this be different from what we rejected 15 years ago? And I was like, wow, you still remember that? You're hurting me. Leave that alone.
Wow.
And I finally convinced them to do it. So it was a calling, I think. I felt like I had to do this book. There was something inside of me saying that this needs to get done. A higher power kind of directing me and pushing me to do this book. And also, I wanted to do the book because the Horned God is one of the primary things about witchcraft. If you look at what people think about witchcraft over the last 1,000 years, it's all, there's always a horned figure in the middle of it, right? I mean, it's usually
sure,
the devil.
Absolutely.
But still wearing horns. And I feel like the horned god has kind of been pushed away over the last couple of decades. And especially, you know, I'll admit sometimes I'm a little petty, you know, like when I, you know, all anybody ever talks about is Hecate. And I'm like, look at him. He's beautiful.
Yeah.
And he has horns. And I want to talk about him, too. So that's why I wrote the book in a very big nutshell. I think that's the story.
And I love
I think that's the story of the book.
I love the part about you, you know, running, dripping wet from the shower to your computer. That's like, I know the other parts of the story, too, because I actually pay attention when you speak. I'm just saying. And I love that part. I do.
Oh, hi.
Yeah.
Not even true. I also wanted to mention, before we go any further, the artwork on the cover by the amazing LTZ, sorry, Laura Tempest-Zakroff. We call her LTZ in my house. We just adore the artwork on the book, and all of LTZ's artwork is amazing. Laura Tempest-Zakroff is an amazing human as well. But the
there's
first
a story
thing
there,
I thought,
too. No, there's,
oh, God,
there's a story
the
about
story,
the artwork,
please.
Too. So, I mean, I've known Tempest for 6 or 7 years now, and we, you know, we wrote a book together
mm-hmm.
a few years ago, The Witch's Altar.
Yep.
But, you know, we really kind of hit it off at, like, we met in, like, August once, and then a few months later she was at the Pantheacon thing again, and she was selling art. And there was this beautiful painting that she'd done, and Ari's like, I want that. And I was like, well, you know, I think we should get something to accompany it, like maybe a Kronos. And she heard us. She goes, I will paint you a Kronos, you know, because she didn't have one.
Wow.
I'll paint it for you.
Yeah.
And then I was like, so we'll buy books of the, and I had no idea how much they were. They were quite expensive, actually.
Right.
My wife yelled at me later. But then we got the Kronos like a month or two later when she had painted it. And it was amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, it was like he was whispering into her ear. It was everything that I wanted a Kronos painting to be. When I think of Kronos now, that's one of the images that first springs into my mind. I loved this image. So when I got the go-ahead to write the book, and then we were talking about the book, and they asked me for ideas about the cover art, I said, I want Tempest to do the cover art. And Tempest had never done the cover art for a book that was not her own. And Llewellyn can be really picky about who gets to do the covers. And so, I mean, I was the first, a trailblazer, that I had Tempest get to do my cover. And, you know, and she knocked it out of the park. You know, she asked me, what do you want to, you know, what are you thinking of? What do you want? And, you know, I sent her some ideas and things. I mean, so I had a little bit of input, but mostly it's all her. And then she painted the horned god's hair blonde in her painting. That was for me. So, I mean, it's really great, and I love it. And I love that painting so much. And then she sold me the original, so I have it sitting in my house.
That's awesome. I love her artwork. I have a lot of it in my house, actually. I need more, but my collection is definitely started. I've got 4 or 5 pieces already up on the walls. And Tempest is just a great human as well. So,
absolutely.
You know, I wanted to ask you because your original go with this book was kind of, you know, a run and a miss, as it were. And I wanted to ask, because I'm not an author, but I used to be a musician. And I remember being told when I was a very young musician, keep writing. It's not all going to be great. As a matter of fact, in the beginning, it's going to suck. But if you keep writing, you get better. And that was about songwriting. Is it the same thing for books?
Absolutely. Writing is like a muscle. The more you use that muscle, the stronger it gets. The more you write, the more you'll improve. And, you know, writing songs or writing books, I mean, there's kind of an art thing to it, right? I mean, not everybody can. Not everybody has the discipline or the language skills to write a book. And that's okay. I mean, and I could never write a song, for instance, as much as I tried. But, I mean, if you have that little seed and you think it's something that you want to do and should do, then you have to practice.
Yeah.
And I think when I started writing, I just thought, well,
you know, I'm a good writer. I can just write. You know, I'll just pick this up when I want to, and it'll come out fine.
Yeah.
And it doesn't. You know, it's you really
right.
need to write, you know, so many thousand words a month to keep in practice and to keep the ideas churning and flowing. You know, and there are times I take a week off here or there. There are times you just want to get, you know, you just want to get the F away from it. But for the most part, you need to do it often. One of the things that, for me, I think would really improve my writing was blog writing. I think if I had never
yeah.
started my blog, Raise the Horns, at Pathos and attracted a readership, I don't think I would ever written a book because I think I'd kind of given up on it. But blogging at the time, two or three times a week, every week, made my writing stronger. It gave me a tone that I could use that was just my tone. You know, like some of my favorite writers, like when you read Tempest, you know you're reading Tempest. When you read John Beckett,
yeah.
you know you're reading John Beckett. And I hope that when
Absolutely.
You read Jason, you know that you're reading Jason. And I think what blogs really help bring out people's voice when they're writing because we become more
mm-hmm.
conversational with how we write. And I think 15
yeah.
years ago that wasn't acceptable, which is one of the reasons I think Llewellyn passed on my earlier attempt at a book. Because I've always been a very conversational writer, but that wasn't the form back then. You weren't really supposed to be too conversational, but online interaction has changed that. But the more you write, the better you'll get at it. And sometimes you need to write even when you don't feel like writing. And I've said this before, you know, some days writing is like pulling teeth, you know, and I know that I've
uh-huh.
got a deadline. I need to write 1,000 words every day. And I'll be like, well, this is going to suck. This is terrible because, like, every sentence takes 30 minutes to write. I mean, it's just agonizingly
mm-hmm.
slow. You're not focused on it. But then sometimes you'll be surprised that when you get done, you're like, wow, this isn't bad at all. And that was the Dionysus bit in the Horned God book. I had a hard
mm-hmm.
time writing that book, really a hard time writing that book. It's footnote heavy. There's a lot of history in it. That's hard stuff to write. And I decided I was just going to go to the wine bar and see what happens. It is a Dionysus chapter, and that's what I did.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like pulling teeth, but, you know, when I read it a couple of months later because I sat it down, I was like, wow, this isn't bad. This isn't bad at all. And that's what ended up going into the book.
Yeah, and I think writing in general is a very difficult thing, and I think people who put themselves under the gun like that, you know, being committed to a blog or being committed to some kind of an online presence like that has to be – you've got to have talent. I'm sorry. You can't just assume you're going to be able to do it. I mean, you're pulling things out of yourself in addition to – gathering the information around you. And I think a lot more folks would like to think they can write, but it's not so easy. I think people make an assumption that writing is easy, and it's really, really not. Not when you have a daily commitment or a weekly commitment like that. I used to write very briefly for a pagan online magazine, and I remember just throwing myself at it, and I did it, I think, a year or two. I can't remember off the top of my head. It's a while back. But I just remember sitting in front of the computer and thinking, what the fuck am I going to write about this week? Let's see.
Yeah.
What haven't I said 7 ways to Sunday already? But, you know, you do come up with it. But I will tell you, the mixture of sadness and relief I had when that online magazine went away is startling, because part of me was like, oh, you know, I think I was starting to actually improve my writing. And then the other part of me was like, I don't have to do that anymore. I mean, but it was that kind of love-hate relationship. And I think some writers are just – some people are just born to write, and I think of you in that term, because you do make it conversational. And I'm sorry, I am not a genius, as if anyone didn't know that already. And I think the ability to relate to your audience and the ability to speak to your audience is very important. When things get very textbook-like, I fall asleep. So I appreciate a more conversational tone, which is why I think you're one of the more popular and more relatable and easier to digest writers because you don't beat people over the head with the information.
I try not to. I mean, I'm sure there are some people who don't like my writing style. You know, and I've ran across one of them on Facebook the other day. You know, so, like, people were like, oh, I just got the Horned God book, and they were really excited. And this one person's like, I tried to read one of his books, and I just don't like his writing at all. You know, and I'm like, I'm right here. Ouch. You're hurting me. You know? When you talk about how hard writing is, though, you know this, and some other people do, that I ran Pathos Pagan for years, right? Like four, five years or something, 6 years. And, you know, people are always like, I would love to blog for you. I want to write at Pathos, right? And so you give them a blog, and they would write two times, and that would be it. Because they thought it would be this easy thing, right? Like, I'm just going to sit down, and I'll just write some stuff. And it's not. It's, you know, even writing a blog post takes time and effort and energy, especially if you're going to write it and try to attract a readership, you know, because people who read stuff in the pagan world are usually very smart. And if you get things wrong, they are more than happy to tell you how wrong you are. And, you know, that can scare you away pretty quickly. Also, you know, and it's, you know, some people just don't have 4 hours or whatever. They think they do, but they don't.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, you have to love it. I'm always amazed that John Beckett still writes three times a week, every week. That's his discipline. He does that.
Yeah.
You know, and sometimes he may not have a whole lot to say. And, you know, like sometimes he does a movie review or something, and I get that. But, you know, that is a level of consistency I've never seen in the pagan blogging world. I mean, The Wild Hunt publishes every day, but it's a collection of writers, so it's not quite the same.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, you were so kind when we started the show almost a decade ago now. You were very kind, and you had made a suggestion that maybe we could write for Pathos. And, you know, so you had been at it a really long time. And, I was like, I can't do that. I don't know how to do – I can't do that. But you were so sweet and so generous, and I don't think I ever properly thanked you for the offer. So thank you.
I wanted that I thought you all would have been huge. Like, you know, you have the best – you have the best name I have ever come across, like, in the pagan world for branding and stuff. I just think it's funny. It's clever. It grabs your attention. I love it so much. I mean, and I don't like just freely throw out my praise unless I really mean it. I just think it's terrific.
Thanks. I will be very honest with you and tell you that neither I nor my former co-host came up with the name. The name was come upon by a former lover of mine. So wherever he is, his ears are probably burning and thanking you for the credit. Thank you very much. I have kept it in spite of certain changes to the show because people know the name. And when I tell people who have never heard of me before, oh, blah, 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 Desperate House Witches, they're like, with a name like that, I have to be on your show. So it has definitely helped. And thank you for saying that. But getting back to the book, you know, I will tell you that as a young witch in the 70s, and very young witch at the time, obviously, or not obviously, there was a huge push to be very goddess-centered. And in the beginning of my education, before I was actually mentored, but in the beginning of my education when I was surrounded by older people practicing paganism and witchcraft, there was very little mention of male deity. And I don't know if it was because of women's lib at the time or if it was just an overall rejection of maleness, but I was surrounded, it seemed, by folks who practiced more of a Dianic practice. And I always felt like something was up with that. And I was really young at the time, and it was before we were in the world that we're in now, which tries to be a more inclusive world, which I'm very appreciative of. Folks who know me know about my involvement in certain communities and my love for certain communities. I don't want to go into it because it just seems like pandering, so I'm just going to leave it at that. But I felt like there was an overall rejection back in the 70s and the 80s of maleness. And I wish there had been this book back then for me, because I was not into the – something for me with the dyadic practices seemed like something was missing.
So I think that for a lot of us, especially, you know, today, like, the definition of witchcraft is sort of changing in a lot of ways. But I think for a lot of us, Gen X and older, you know, it was very much a kind of a religious thing, right, or a spiritual thing.
Yeah.
You know, we got into
Absolutely.
This. I mean, yes, doing magic was important, but also to connect with higher powers, deity. And worshiping a goddess is novel, right? It's unique and different, especially in the Western world. And I think a lot of people come to witchcraft, especially Wicca, because of the goddess, because there's not another outlet for that. So because of that, we put a lot of emphasis on her. And I think that's fine. I mean, it's why I ended up here. You know, I was terrified of the Horned God for years. You know, I wanted to focus on the goddess. So that ended up being the thing. I also believe that in the late 70s, and throughout the 80s and into the early 90s, you know, satanic panic was a real thing. People often talk about it like a joke or that it wasn't real. But people went to jail for decades because of unsubstantiated allegations of child abuse, usually at daycares. You know, there were people still in jail in the 2000s over this. And because of that fear of Satan, I think that we specifically downplayed the God, especially the Horned God. You know, like, you read books, like Gerald Gardner was pretty specific, you know, Horned God, you know, it's there. You read Paul Hewson's Mastering Witchcraft. You know, they're not all cuddly sun gods in Paul Hewson's Mastering Witchcraft. And, you know, and then in the late 70s, that changed. And, you know, it was, well, this figure is in a very much a secondary role. You know, he doesn't have any power at all. He only gets it through her. You know, there's a god in this, but you can call it whatever you want. And, yeah, to some witches it has horns, but for a lot of other witches it doesn't have horns. So it doesn't really have to be a horned god, right? I mean, and it kind of changed things. I think we really downplayed Hornhead for those two particular reasons. You know, I don't like saying novelty. I don't want people to say that I'm dismissing it. That's not at all. But, I mean, it's just unique, right, to have a goddess. It's a big deal when you're coming to this.
Sure.
It's comforting. It feels like something is complete. But at the same time, too, while we did that, you know, satanic panic's, you know, going on, so we sort of downplayed our male deity who had been, in a lot of instances, horned. So I think those two factors had a lot to do with it. And if you go through the 90s, you see us sort of kind of get out of that, especially. You know, there's a little more emphasis, especially on the horned god. Traditional witchcraft, so traditional witches usually hate Wiccans, right? I mean, it's a thing online. Wicca sucks. Traditional witchcraft's better. Wiccans are bad. Their conception of the horned god is so much like more like what mine is. It's actually more like what Gerald Gardner's is. You know, and I think that they've been really instrumental in sort of bringing back the place of the horned god in a lot of things that we do. You know, like, because to them, that is the more primary of the deities, is the horned one. And so I think that they've kind of pushed him back into the spotlight a little bit.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, one of the things I also noticed is that when people talk about male deity, it always felt to me like all male deity was kind of pushed into this amalgam instead of being separate entities. Like, you lay out very specific differences in your book. And I think it's like a re-education for me because everything got like shoved into a corner in favor of the goddess. So for me, it's like a whole new education, because I will admit, when I was being mentored, it was a very because my mentor referred to us as gardenias as opposed to gardenarians, like we were gardenarian-ish. So there were certain
sorry,
things that, you know, so we were gardenias instead of gardenarians specifically.
Amazing.
But a lot of our stuff came from Gardner, obviously. But, you know, it just seemed like people were, you know, even in my group, were not so concerned, not necessarily afraid of, but not so concerned with male deities, that everything was a lot more female focused. And I guess, you know, and I still go back to the, you know, the women's movement as being part of that, and, you know, wanting women to feel empowered. And I'm very appreciative of that, but, you know, things grow and change, and now we're in a world where, you know, we have, like Ellen of the Ways, I completely learned from you. I never heard of Ellen of the Ways before you. Can you talk to folks a little bit about Ellen, who may not also know of her?
So for the last, and I've seen it kind of on and off for the last 10 years, though she was first written about in the 80s, there's a reindeer goddess mm-hmm. called Ellen of the Ways. And it's not a goddess that's really in the historical record. A feminist scholar named mm-hmm. Caroline Wise, you know, she was kind of looking between the lines and you know, sees things in the Mabinogion and a few other spaces and thinks, hey, you know, maybe there was this reindeer goddess that kind of got pushed aside, right? So I want to write about her. And I think that her name is Ellen or Helen, which is the figure in the Mabinogion that she, you know, uses to say that this goddess was probably real. And, you know, she wrote mm-hmm. some online stuff. You know, the self-published a few books, but I think those even came much later. But the idea, like, really resonated with people. And I would go to festivals, and people would say, Jason, what about Ellen of the Ways? And I would look at them with this bewildered expression on my face. What? You know, because I didn't know. So I decided that I needed to find out about it, right? And I'll admit,
yeah.
you know, when a god does not have, a deity does not have mythology, when a deity does not have really much in the way of attested to historical record, like, you know, artifacts,
yeah.
statues, I tend to be skeptical, you know, that's just sort of my nature. And so I was kind of skeptical
yeah.
of Ellen, and then I'm writing the book, and, you know, I'm putting all that together, and then I, you know, I just kind of Google Ellen of the Ways on Amazon, and, you know, there are statues from, like, big
yeah.
statue companies, and they say Ellen of the Ways on them. And you know, they're, like, mass-produced in China, which is usually not a good thing, but it says something in this case, right? Like, this deity resonates with people. And you can find T-shirts.
Sure.
And then there are a couple of books now that are not necessarily from Wise. They're from other people who've had experiences with Ellen. You know, there, none of them are big, like, Wiser, Llewellyn, or Simon & Schuster books. But, you know, they're published,
right.
you know, even if they're self-published, people are feeling the need to write and to share the information. And I go to festivals and I see her on T-shirts and things. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, why am I skeptical? You know, why am I wanting to be an asshole about this? If we believe
mm-hmm.
that deities have agency, right, that they're active
yeah.
in this world and that they're real, and all of a sudden this
mm-hmm.
deity is on statues and T-shirts and people are writing books about her and having experiences with her, isn't that all that you need to be like a real deity? I mean, it isn't, there's a power there that's expressing itself. And you don't have to follow the power or, you know, believe in the power or whatever. But, I mean, I think it's pretty much plain as day that it's obviously real
yeah.
or it wouldn't be here in this way. So that's kind of the Ellen story. You know, I don't dedicate a lot of the book to it. I mean, it's just maybe two pages or something. But I knew when I put the book together that I was going to put Ellen in it. That was just one of my thoughts, that she would have to be in this book just because I got questions about her. But also, you know, I believe things like the Horned God are an ongoing story. So it just doesn't
yeah.
end
in 1954 when Gardner writes about the Horned God for the first time, or when Margaret Murray writes about the Horned God of the Witches in 1931. It's continuous. It goes forward. And that this figure is here and resonates with people, that means it's part of the story. So I felt like it had to be in the book. There's a lot of people, like when I read Amazon reviews, that's like a big critique. He writes about horned goddesses too. it's one. I think I added it up the other day. It's 1.6% of the entire book, but that really upsets and disturbs some people. And it's unfortunate. I think because I think deity is greater than us, right? So I feel like it can appear in a variety of forms.
Well, yeah, and look, in case people didn't notice, the book isn't called The Male Horned God of the Witches. It's The Horned God of the Witches. Just saying, I don't think you specified on the cover anywhere that would mislead people to think it was male only. I don't know. I like a point that you make about, gods, goddesses, deity having the ability to change and not just be one sexuality or one structure. And I think, the need for people to identify with their deities, I think we have this obvious habit of making gods to be like us. And they're not necessarily like us. They're gods. I am soft polytheist. I believe that there are many, but somewhere, because they're gods, they're somehow connected. And that's just where I go with it in my head. But I do believe that, as easy as a god can morph into an animal or a human or a tree, everything's on the table. Gods can, they're fucking gods. That's why they can do what the fuck they want. You know what I mean? That's just my take on it. And I know it sounds very simple, but I think the more we get away from gods having agency and being able to do whatever it is they please, the more we limit them to what we are in our experience. What do you think?
It's really strange to me when people, who are really devout about deity, they talk about deity, and so much of what they talk about is grounded in what happened 2,000 years ago. And, I get that. Those gods were being actively worshipped 2,000 years ago. People were sacrificing to them, praying to them, working with them, et cetera, et cetera. But everything is, again, it's an evolution, right? And it doesn't stand still. And it moves forward. And I think of deities like Ellen of the Ways. And the book also talks about, and this is another thing that upset some people, is, there were female representations of Pan in the ancient world. They weren't common, but sometimes you would see Pan, and Pan would have a kind of a fetching feminine figure with breasts. And there was a deity in Gaul, where Cronos was worshipped, which is modern-day France, Gaul. And, it has horns on, it has antlers on its head, right? And it's clearly female and, worshipped, in similar places where Cronos was. And, could it be a female Cronos or the spouse of Cronos or the daughter of Cronos? We don't know, right? But it's there.
Right.
It says that there was this antlered female figure that meant something to at least some of these people. And to me, when I think about these figures and I think about Ellen, I think that they're meant to be a way into the mysteries of the Horned God, right? And I think a lot of us, especially coming from Christianity or just the awfulness of men in general sometimes, we have trouble connecting with that divine male, so to speak, right? And so instead we have these other options, right, to take the mysteries of the Horned God forward. To me, the Horned God is a god of nature and life and love and pleasure and joy and exuberance and being ecstatic, all these beautiful things. And you can experience those things with the Horned God. But if you don't like male deities, I think these other things are the Horned One's way of saying, here, you can still take my hand or my hoof, and you can come forward and you can do this stuff with me, and I'll make it easier. I'll give you a way in. And I love that. And I don't understand why people want to close those doors. Right? It's just like, it doesn't hurt you, for that door to be open. And I always take pains in the book, like your definition of a horned god may be different than mine, and that's fine. How you interact with the horned god may be very different from how I do it. So, I mean, if you don't think Ellen's a horned god in the traditional sense, and you don't like female versions of Pan and Kronos and the Green Man, you can just, throw that out if you want. I don't care, but I feel like it needs to be acknowledged, and it needs to be written about, and people need to know it's there. Because I think when you're a writer, it's about opening doors, and it's not about closing them.
Yeah. Yeah, and, I think part of the beauty of being pagan, whatever, is the ability to accept other deities other than the ones that we've been reading about forever. And I agree with you, this need to only believe things that existed thousands of years ago, I think it's a trap. I really do. I think gods change. I think there's gods we have no fucking clue about that haven't made themselves evident to us yet. I think in another number of thousands of years or hundreds of years even, there will be gods spoken about that we didn't have a clue about. Things are going to be discovered. There's so much that we don't know. And the older I get, the more I realize I know even less, which is kind of cool because then I get to talk to people like you and you educate me on other things that I don't know about, which is kind of why I'm here. But
I feel dumber the older I get. I feel like I know less the older I get. There are more questions. There are more mysteries, right?
Exactly.
In my early 20s, I thought I had the answers. And, then you realize you really don't have the answers.
At 20, I wasn't even sure what the fucking questions were. Are you kidding? I'm still trying to figure it all out. I don't even know what to ask half the time. But the fact of the matter is that this need to, because I love some of the younger folks who are like, yeah, but this practice is like, hundreds and hundreds of years old, and I'm like, actually, we didn't get it over here until I was born, so maybe you want to relax a little bit. It's not ancient, all of it. A lot of it isn't, actually. A lot of the, obviously, Gardnerian, it's not thousands of years old. I'm not saying that there aren't magical practices. Yeah, I know, right?
What?
I know, I was shocked.
What?
I was like, what do you mean he wasn't living in a cave? I know, right?
But I
just find it hilarious. I know, I'm being ridiculous, and I know you'll never speak to me again after this, but it's true. When people are like, well, you – what? Now you're just making me laugh. Stop. But
yeah, sorry.
I know, it's
just easy.
People,
it's funny.
No, you're great. It's just – I just find it hilarious that people are horrified when I'm like, no. If you're a Game of Thrones fan, we're worshiping new gods too. Relax, it's okay. I mean, there's a pantheon, of course, that if you follow Greek or you follow Roman or whatever, that you can trace certain worship styles back thousands of years. Sure, but a lot of us believe stuff that's kind of new in the spectrum of life, and that's okay. So when I never heard of Ellen of the Ways before this particular book, and was like, oh, maybe I should start investigating that. So I mean, that's really cool, and I just want people to be more open to, it's not that the gods are fitting into our box, as it were. We're expanding our belief and our acceptance and who we are and our thoughts about it. When you limit what the gods can do, feel, say, whatever, you're making them like you. We worship gods because they're fucking gods. Okay. I know that's very irreverent, but there's a reason why you go to something higher than yourself. I'm not trying to force a God to be like me. I don't want a God that's like me. That's scary. So, because I know the shit I've done.
You know, like, when I think about people believing that the gods have to stay in the box that they were in 2,000 years ago, I find that problematic for a couple of reasons. First of all, we know that the gods evolved in places like ancient Greece and Rome. You know, we can see that in the historical record. We can see that in how they're written about, and we can see that in how they're worshipped. And then a very close connection with Pan. I mean, Pan is the reason I wrote this book. Pan was the first horned god I ever had a relationship with and fell in love with.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Pan in the ancient world was, I don't want to insult my guy, but, you know, he was kind of like a bee god, right? He wasn't, you know, like a top dog.
Yeah.
I mean, he was like a solid B-minus sort of god. And all of a sudden in the 19th century, and also, you know, he indulged in a lot of bad behaviors in mythology, right? I mean, this is not is not the god you wanted anyone to date, right? or even have like a rendezvous with. And then, you know, so fast forward, you know, 2,000 years, 1,800 years or whatever, and Pan is all of a sudden being written about in a new way. Pan is now the god of the countryside. Pan is a lot more serene. Pan is a way to connect with nature in a way that Pan hadn't been used to connect with nature in the ancient world. You know, and he was written about in this much, much more pleasant way. And I've seen people like, well, that's not really Pan. And I'm like, of course it's really Pan. Do you think these people were writing this just, you know, because they wanted to, like, intentionally, like, screw up how a god is perceived or something? You have to believe that Pan is whispering in their ear, right? Like, that he is actively involved in this redoing of his myth and who he is. So to me, mythology is always actively going. It's always taking place. And I mean, we should be wary sometimes of what we call personal gnosis, right? I mean, you know, there are things that people might say just to take advantage of others, or perhaps, you know, their spiritual moment was more the product of a substance or something than a reality. But when a bunch of people have that same sort of feeling and they write about it, I mean, then I think we have to take it seriously as becoming real. So to me, that's a lot of what the Horned God's about. And people who want to keep Pan in the year 50, you know, aren't really respecting Pan, because obviously the story's been moving forward for a while.
Absolutely. And again, you know, as the world changes, you know, nothing stays the same. The gods don't stay the same. We don't stay the same. You know, we're constantly in the situation of evolution, hopefully. And I just find, you know, we're a product of the things we are taught, and we're a product of the environment we've grown up in. And, you know, if you stay in that one spot, then you don't change and you don't grow, and neither do your experiences. But I think, because I know, you know, a lot of people get a lot of flack from folks out there saying, yeah, but you're not being inclusive, or you're being too inclusive. And it's like, no, it is what it is. This is where we are. We have all grown and changed. We are moving forward. And I just kind of shake my head sometimes when I hear that people are getting flack for saying, no, you know, everything is evolving. It does happen. We do this. I don't know. I get concerned that people want to close down certain avenues, and I'm sorry that they want to do that, because that's not growth. And I have a problem with that, you know, but I think the book is great. I am in the middle of it, and I can't wait to get through the second half of it. And I think it's wonderful, and I'm glad that you wrote it, because quite frankly, I was not taught a lot about male deity. Again, very specifically goddess oriented. So I kind of feel like I've missed out on a lot in that
regard.
Well,
I mean, if you look at sort of the witch books, especially that were available for a long time in the 90s, mm-hmm. you know, those are the first time any sort of like male only book, right, God book had ever been published, I think was in the 90s. And there were really only two of them that were kind of easily available. There was the Farrar's The Witch's God, which was about all the different versions of the god, you know, like there's the sky god and, you know, maybe the horn mm-hmm. god or whatever. But, I mean, it's just a little teeny chapter. And then there was DJ Conway's Lord of Light and Shadow, which was a companion to her book Maiden Mother Crone. But, again, not specifically focused on the horn gods, you know, sun gods are in there, underworld gods, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, so we've never really had a book like this before. There were a few that kind of came close, but they were usually by small publishers. Cabell Bann published some in the 90s. There was In Search of Herne the Hunter by a writer named Eric Fitch, which is a fantastic book if you're interested in Herne. But those books never had a lot of distribution in the United States, and Cabell Bann shut down a few years ago. So now all those titles are selling for like $1,000 online. And while they're kind of good books, they're usually not worth that. And there was also Masks of Misrule by a writer named Nigel Jackson. But especially Masks of Misrule was really kind of a more romanticized take on the Horned God, through the prism of Margaret Murray than actual real history. You know, it's about the Horned God being connected to sort of everything. And, you know, there's some huge leaps when it comes to the history of witchcraft and unbroken chains and stuff. But, you know, that was it. And as I said, most people never got a hold of those books because they just weren't easily available. So for people like, you know, trying to, you know, don't beat yourself up. Like nobody had any of this stuff because it just wasn't out there. You just couldn't have any of this stuff. And so, I'm excited and proud of this book because it is sort of radically different than what came before it, because there's never really been a book like this, especially from, you know, a major occult publisher.
I agree. And I think that's why I'm like so appreciative that you wrote it. And we're kind of running a little bit down on time. So I wanted to ask, now that you have put out this book that you wanted to put out before, how do you follow this up?
Well, I mean, I'm almost done with the next book. Well, actually, that book number eight is already done. It's called The Witch's Book of Spellcraft. Oh. And I've always wanted to write a magic book, right? I mean, I feel like if you're going to be a witchcraft author, you know, you have to write your magic book with, you know, 100 spells in it and how to do different kinds of magic. So that's the next one, The Witch's Book of Spellcraft, and that'll be out in March. And then right now I'm finishing up The Witch's Guide to the Greek Gods. And I'm writing that with my friend Estrella Taylor, who wrote Intuitive Witchcraft. She's terrific. And it's a history of the gods of ancient Greece and, to a small degree, ancient Rome, and how they were worshipped then and then how they were worshipped going forward, because it just doesn't stop, you know, in 381 when Christianity became the official religion of the Roman Empire. You know, it talks about, you know, how gods were worshipped after that and how they kind of hung around in a lot of ways. And then it has a bunch of outside contributors, too. And hopefully that will be done very, very shortly, and it should be out in, like, next year, probably in November, December or something.
Wow.
So, yeah, there's a lot of things. And then I'm contracted to write a biography of Ray Buckland after that, which I'll be starting in September. So, yeah, there's so much shit to do. And then I know the two books after that. So, yeah, I've got like three books on my plate.
Raymond Buckland's biography, that must be intimidating.
It
oh
is very scary. I wish I'd said no. I really do sometimes.
No, you don't.
I do. We'll see. You know, it's a different discipline, right? Writing a biography.
Sure.
So we'll see how that works.
Sure.
I do want to write a good Wicca 101 book, which is going to happen. And then I want to write a book that's similar to The Horned God of the Witches, but focusing on the goddess. You know, one of the things I'm most proud of on The Horned God of the Witches is, you know, you could spend a lot of time on ancient stuff, but really, you know, a lot of how we look at the Horned God is a result of modern circumstances. It's a result of modern writers like Robert Graves and especially Margaret Murray and Gerald Gardner and things. And that's really sort of the last half of the book. And I think those are the best chapters in the book. I'm so proud of those. And I want to do the same thing with the goddess, right, and kind of go over the different influences and some of the stuff in the ancient world. Like, you know, there are a few goddesses that I think have an oversized role today. Hecate would be one, maybe the Morrigan, certainly Ariadne from – or not Ariadne, but Aradia from Gospel of the Witches by Charles Leland. So, and kind of look at those things. Yeah, there's always something. You know, really, I just want to get drunk for like a year straight and watch football, but I probably won't do that.
No, I don't think so. Not yet. Not for a long time. Maybe when you retire, if that ever happens. But hopefully that's a very, very, very long time off. But I'm fascinated by the way you write. I'm fascinated even more by the amount you write. You're probably one of the most prolific writers I've ever had the pleasure of meeting, and I love the way you write. So to whoever doesn't like it, because I don't care. Everything is not for everyone necessarily, but I would say the vast majority of people do love the way you write. So I'm very appreciative that you've actually come and spend some time with me.
Anytime. I always love talking to you. You know, I'm always open. You know, if you wanna hang out and chat, I'm always around.
Which is great, and I'm very appreciative of that as well.
When you're desperate for a guest, I'm there. I'm there.
Well, I mean, you're very sweet to offer, and I actually do want to book you for your next book as well, which we'll do after this, hopefully. But I am happy that we are somewhat coming out of, I don't know, what do you think? Are we all going to be able to see each other next year or something? Is the Delta variant just going to keep things rolling the way they are right now? I just want your quick take on it before we go.
I think it's going to continue. I think we're still going to have people getting sick. The unvaccinated population is going to go to the hospital, and some of those individuals are going to die. And I think that's a shame because I think there's a way to prevent that from happening by getting vaccinated. But I don't think that we're going to have the shutdown that we did because there is a way out, right? And if people choose to take it, you know, they can be safe from this. I mean, you get vaccinated, you can still get sick. But the difference is that you don't go to the hospital.
True.
You don't die, right? I mean, it makes a big difference.
Right.
And I think also what we're going to look at is certain areas are going to be hit harder than other areas, depending on vaccination rates. Where I live, we have a very high vaccination rate. I feel pretty good about going outside and going to places. And when I'm inside, like at a grocery store, I still wear a mask and stuff. But when I go to the bar after this, you know, I'm not going to wear a mask, you know, because I'm, you know, also confident that everybody is vaccinated, which is, you know, exciting. So I think that we'll have events.
It is.
But I think that some of those events will make people sick. And if people have not taken the necessary precautions, some of that sickness could be very severe. But I don't think we're going to completely shut down again. I hope not.
Well, that would be good. I hope not. Do you have any events coming up? Yeah. Do you have any events coming up, public events?
I finally do. I mean, it's in 2019, I think I like went somewhere every 3 weeks. And then 2020, you know, was just grounded.
But in October, I'm doing Witches Soiree in Las Vegas.
Nice.
It's a Thursday night. It's kind of in the middle of the month, but there'll be a lot of witchcraft things there. A lot of there'll be readers and dancers and all kinds of crazy things. And it's in one of my favorite cities, so that's fun. I don't really have anything to do there other than I'm supposed to mingle with people. So I'm really excited about that.
That's great.
And then the next to last week of October, which is the weekend before Samhain, I'm doing the Iowa City Metaphysical Fair, which was I supposed to do last year. And I'm very excited about that. I'm a Midwest boy. My grandmother grew up on a farm. Our family still owns a farm, so I'm very excited to be headed that way in the autumn.
Nice.
And then I'm going to Salem the last week of September. I don't have anything planned, but if you live on the East Coast in New England, I will be around. So that's kind of
nice.
That's kind of neat. Yeah, and then
that's great.
You know, and then Convocation 2022 in Detroit in February, but that's when things kind of start up again. But yeah, it's strange not to go to outdoor festivals. Strange not to be at Mystic South this year. You know, it's been weird to be stuck at home so much.
Agreed. Well, hopefully I'll get to see you at Mystic South 2022 because my understanding is that's happening.
Yeah, I think that they were a little premature in canceling it. I think it probably could have happened this late July. But I also understand people being cautious and things, and we need everybody to be comfortable when they go somewhere. But yeah, if it had happened this year, I would have been there for sure.
Yeah. Well, hopefully I'll get to see you next year. But in the meantime, Jason, thank you so much again. The book is The Horned God of the Witches. Pick it up. It's not necessarily what you think it is in your head. Give it a shot. It's a great book. And Jason Mankey, thank you again for spending the hour with me, and we will speak again soon.
Thank you for having me. I always love being on the show.
Love having you, too. Bye-bye. All right, everybody,
bye.
I'm going to wrap it right here. Bye. I'll see you next week. Have a wonderful week. Take care. Get your shot if you haven't. Bye.